Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Chris Bernor.
Feature.
He's Chris Bernor. I'm Duane DeFreitas.
First of all, before we get started, I want to welcome new listeners from geeksofdoom.com. We're extremely happy to share ourselves with the Geeks of Doom audience, and we thank Dave and Eve over at Geeks of Doom for the opportunity. I've known those guys for years, and they are like family to me. And I think Geeks of Doom has some of the best media coverage on the web, and we're humbled to be in such fine company. Our goal on this show is to provide the Geeks of Doom listeners with the same in-depth, informed coverage on tech and social media that they've already come to expect on comics, films, music, and geek culture. So hopefully we can accomplish that. Now, this is our 220th episode, but for most listeners on the Geeks of Doom, this is the first time you've ever heard us, so let's do introductions all around. I am a film editor. I have 20 years of experience. I'm also very heavily into social media. I'm a social media enthusiast. I've been called the king of social media by some journalists, And I just love tech, and this is what I do. Let's go around, and I'll start with you, Duane. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Duane DeFreitas. I am from Brooklyn. I live in Boulder. I work at a advertising technology startup now made mature by my wonderful two partners. And I do compliance and research and analytics work for them when they need it. So, yeah.
How about yourself, Chris?
I am originally from New Jersey, but I came out here to Silicon Valley about exactly 2 years ago almost. I'm currently the CTO of Startup Digest, which is a media company that helps startups in about 85 cities or so around the world connect, and I basically keep the servers running and build out new features for them. And I love social media too. I'm not a hide in the corner geek.
We all love social media. We're just not where Andy is.
We usually have one more co-host on the show, regular co-host on the show, Devendra Hardawar.
Devendra!
Who is...
I'm a fan.
one of the lead editors for VentureBeat.com, and he's out sick this week, so we wish him a speedy recovery, and we'll probably get with him again on next week's episode. And also, occasionally on the show, we'll have Tom Chardar, who is a columnist here at Geeks of Doom, and also a columnist at VentureBeat.
And does he not have a podcast at Geeks of Doom?
He does. He does the TARDIS Blend, the Doctor Who podcast here on Geeks of Doom. So he's a semi-regular on our show. And as well as Lydia Davis, who is an editor over at techmeme.com. So we have a full complement of experienced tech analysts in this podcast. So hopefully Lydia,
pundits.
Wait, there's pundits. Also Sean.
Sean occasionally. Sean Ludwig from VentureBeat.
He's one of our favorites. He's a great guy. All these people are good. Andy has an ability to pull in people who you want to hear, who know their stuff. So exciting.
So what we usually do on the show is we go through a series of headlines, and then we drill down into one main topic, and then we finish off the show with the final word. And before we even get into the headlines, I have to throw in a curveball here. I want to talk about our audio hosting situation here. Over the last couple of days, our regular audio host, Mevio, suspended a large number of their customers, including us, from their free service, which locks down their podcast completely, and there's no way to change the XML to move the podcast and set iTunes to point to a new server. Mevio mentioned nothing about this on their site, nor did they inform any of their customers. So we're in the process of looking for alternative audio hosting for the MP3 version of the site, and we'll certainly inform everybody of where that is when we lock that down. But the takeaway there is that when you do a major change like what Media is doing, either you shut down entirely and reopen or explain every step of the way. But when you take a swath of your user base used to your old system in order to clear space for a new mission, you do little but spread bad will. In the end, it's important to pivot, but when you must, don't take out your customers while you do it. That I'm quoting there from a TechCrunch article on the situation. So,
you think this is a mistake, or you think this is a deliberate change that they just failed to publicize?
I think it's a deliberate change, and they forgot to publicize it.
How much would it cost for us to keep Mevio and do what we want to do with them?
Well, Mevio doesn't offer you can't pay for service on Mevio. You have to be invited through them as part of their team.
Wow, that's yeah. really expensive, because the money is the cheapest way to pay for anything.
Yeah. So I think we're probably going to be looking at Libsyn from now on. So, but we'll figure that out when we sometime between now and the time we release our podcast, which is usually Friday. Okay, let's move into our first story of the week, which is about the next Xbox. The next Xbox, which would potentially be called the Xbox 720. The next Xbox is due to ship to retailers in late October or early November of next year, according to sources close to the project. It's going to have 6 times the processing power of the Xbox 360. It's going to be based on AMD's 7000 series Southern Island. I'm sorry, it's not going to be based on the Southern Island GPU, the 7000 series. Instead, it's going to be based on the 6000 series, which was introduced last year. It'll be akin to the Radeon HD 6670.
Whoa.
Yeah. So in real terms, the Xbox 720's raw graphic processing power is expected to be 6 times that of the Xbox 360, and yield 20% greater performance than Nintendo's forthcoming console, the Wii U. Now, I've seen the Wii U, and I actually wasn't impressed with their performance, but maybe they weren't cranking it up all the way.
Well, I think a big problem here, when you look at these like specs and stuff, we're not factoring in what I like to call the Apple factor, the idea that regardless of the specifications, the developers only have one piece of hardware to focus on.
Yeah.
So they can make that hardware run incredibly fast. So like, I hear 6600, and I'm like, it's, first of all, the idea that something can come out at the end of next year and be using a video processor from this year, in the PC gaming world, even the Mac gaming world today with Steam and all the other stuff that Mac has access to, mm-hmm. it sounds kind of slow. But then I think about the fact that all they have to focus on is this particular piece of hardware. And look what Apple's done with, like, you know, the iPad and the iPhone. And you begin to realize, oh, that's probably going to be okay.
Well, if you notice, like, video games that come out near the beginning of a generation generally don't look as good as video games that come out on the same platform near the end of the generation.
Yeah.
Like, it's always the it always improves because they learn better how, you know, to improve the what gets rendered on the screen. And you're right. I mean, the base hardware is not as important as the fact that it's going to be super optimized. And it'll be exciting to see what they come out with and what they can do. I'm more excited about, honestly, how Xbox is going to tie into the rest of the things that Microsoft is going to be doing to sort
it's
of build
content.
Out.
Pop. It's the content. Yeah. The content is doing the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're really going to have to. I cannot wait to see the types of games that come out when they know how to push that, you know, push the hardware to its limits. So that's what I'm really looking forward to.
I know I have an Xbox. I don't use it that often, but it does allow me to keep connected to, like, my college basketball, which I'm really into. And it does a great job at that. And it does a good job at Netflix and Amazon and those other things. So you know.
Speaking of, you can watch basketball on it? I didn't know that.
yeah. Well, it's a confluence of a couple of things. You have to have an Xbox. You have to have Xbox Live. So that's like $30 a month. Or $30 a year, rather. $36 a year. I got this deal. And then I'm on Comcast. So Comcast is paying ESPN for this. Hmm. You know what I mean? So it's not like it just happens when you have an Xbox. You have to do like get the Xbox Live plus have like Comcast and Comcast pays for it. So it's kind of what's going on. But still, it works. And since I don't have an actual like cable subscription for TV, it works really well. So between that, my Xbox and Plex, I'm in good shape.
Nice. Now you were talking about you can watch Netflix on that. Let's move into that. Speaking of Netflix, they've regained almost as many customers as they've lost following an unpopular price increase, signaling that the video subscription service is healing from its self-inflicted wounds.
Like a phoenix rising out of the ashes.
they gained 600,000 customers in their fourth quarter compared to a loss of 800,000 subscribers last summer. And the shares surged 16%. I'm actually amazed by this because I thought I was really kind of worried about this for Netflix.
I think it was a big gift. And I think it was a big gift partly because I received Netflix as a gift. I've been a Netflix subscriber for some time. And I have friends who are like, you know what? What do you get the guy who has every tech toy he wants? We're going to get him a year's worth of Netflix. So I got that. And I think that there are other people, like I know for me, like I got my mom a Blu-ray player with Netflix, you know, connection on it. And I got that for her and I hooked up Netflix and I'm paying for Netflix for her. And I know a couple other people who did that because it's the gift that you can give someone. And as long as they have a device to receive the service, you know, it's a relatively high value gift. Like you get a lot of value out of it, if you want to. So I think that it's in the Christmas season. It doesn't seem like it's going to. Or even if you just give them the hardware and they go and get the service themselves, it's not going to break their bank. Okay, I'll get that. I have the service. I have the hardware now. It's so easy. I think that what Netflix offers, I mean, clearly there have been problems with it. Clearly the content owners have said, hey, we want more money for the stuff we're giving you. It was experimental before, and now it's mainstream. Pay for mainstream prices for this stuff. But at the same time, I feel like Netflix has, you know, it's clear that Netflix has, you know, a value. People would rather pay Netflix than pay the cable companies, and
most of the streaming gains will be offset by cancellations of DVD by mail rental plans, which Netflix is gradually phasing out. The CEO Reed Hastings says that believes that discs are becoming increasingly antiquated, and
they cost them money.
He predicts their subscriptions are going to fall from 11.2 million to 9.7 million. He says we expect DVD subscribers to decline every quarter forever. So
That makes sense. I mean, do you remember that site that came out that allowed you a while back to figure out like how much you were paying per movie for Netflix? Like you would, I don't remember, enter your API information or something, and it would like basically look at like how long you've had emails. And you know, for most people, you like get the DVD and you hang on to it for like a month or something, and you like think that it's this great service, but then you're basically paying $14 for a single DVD you could buy for less than that.
Oh, dude, I even lent a DVD to my friend. I lent her Speed because I was like, look, you have not seen Speed. You're 30 years old. You need to see Speed. It's like part of our generation. I'll get to it when I can. You know, I'm busy. So I'm just losing money on that, like left and right.
My strategy was when I was on the disc plan, and I probably shouldn't say this, but I would time shift my discs. I would rent them, rip.
You would pull the data off the disc?
Pull the data off the disc and then turn around and send it right back to Netflix. And then I'd wait until I had the time to watch the movie. But then, to my credit, as soon as I was done watching the movie, I would delete the data.
Was that a hard drive space issue or was that a moral issue?
It was a moral issue, really.
Okay. I feel as if, you know, Netflix, they give you the disc, you go, you put it in, you time shift. And like, first of all, kudos to whatever ripper you were using because those things are scratched the hell up. You get a Netflix disc, you're lucky if it plays.
Really? Yes. I don't know. I find they're a 1,000 times better than any other DVD rental service.
Well,
out there.
Well, no, I mean, all DVD rental sucks. But I'm saying, like, even so, like, every time I get a Netflix disc, I'm like, ooh, my computer might be skipping, my drive might be skipping, whatever.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Warner Brothers news related to Netflix. They now earlier this month, Warner Brothers decided to delay all their new DVD movie releases from becoming available through rental services like Blockbuster and Netflix. So that meant that most people would have to wait 56 days as opposed to the 28 days that many other studios restricted Netflix to. So they'd have to wait 56 days before after a Warner Brothers DVD hit retail store shelves before the Netflix consumers could start renting them. And now, as if that's not enough, Warner Brothers is now imposing additional stipulations for its DVD movie new releases. Starting today, actually, this February 1st, right? Yeah, starting today, Warner Brothers has decided to restrict Netflix users from adding any new DVD releases to their queue. You can't even add the DVD to your queue until 28 days after the DVD goes on sale in retail stores. That's just...
Wait.
Yes.
So, like, the pre-release queues? Like, you know,
yeah,
like...
you can't
like...
add the DVD to your pre-release queue.
Man, that really is what... That clearly is what's eating into their profits. That's clearly the root of everything that is wrong with...
It's clear the
that's going to save American jobs. That is going to save the economy. Like, yeah, move of
Obama's
genius.
A shoo-in. We don't even need the expert Mitt Romney anymore because as long as we have that, we're fine.
And I'm reading here from an article posted by Tom Cheridar at VentureBeat. He says the company thinks that lengthening the time it takes for a movie to reach other platforms, it will increase demand for the DVD and in turn make more money. But not allowing Netflix users to conveniently wait out the delayed availability of new DVDs fits within Warner Brothers' new strategy. The company clearly wants consumers to feel the inconvenience and discomfort of not being able to watch these newly released movies immediately because it makes the option of buying the DVD much more attractive. But you know what? There's no way. I mean, I can't remember the last DVD that I bought because I think I buy it all Blu-ray now. But even as so, with...
this is not like I think this is like not the biggest deal. Honestly, like okay, I've got a DVD to sell and I can rent the DVD. Let me sell the DVD before I rent the DVD. Let me do some price discrimination. I think it's actually okay. I think it's, you know, those people who are just not interested in having it immediately, they just won't get it immediately because they can wait. Those people who need it right now, they'll buy it, they'll go to Amazon or eBay and they'll sell it or they'll keep it depending on how their collection preferences are stated. And I think everybody wins this way.
Yeah. Well, do they? Everybody win? I don't know. I just, like, on the one hand, you're right. I don't think it's going to affect too many people because, like, on the one hand, there's people who see it in theaters and are obsessed with it and or buy the DVD or whatever they do. And then there's people like me who are like, oh, man, that movie that won all those awards 2 years ago, I should get around to watching that.
Exactly.
And, like, I don't care. Like, I don't watch something 28 days after it starts. I usually watch it, like, you know,
right.
A year.
As, like, for me, as far as I'm concerned, I've usually already, before the movie has even come out on DVD, I've already made the decision in my mind what movies I want to buy when they come out, what movies I'm going to wait for rental. So in the long run, it doesn't matter to me.
Right. Or you could be like me, who's got an aunt who's in like whatever guild the people get the screeners from, and we can sit and watch it together. And then I say, that was awesome. I've never touched that disc, and I'll hopefully see it on Netflix again one day a long time from now. And boom.
That's good.
Nice. Okay, moving on. Let's talk about Twitter. Okay, so until now, Twitter has not had the ability to censor certain tweets or accounts or prevent them from being seen if legally required by users in other countries. And now that is all different. Though Twitter stresses it has not yet used this new ability that should it have to, anything withheld will be disclosed. But these types of censorship demands have long been placed against search engines like Google or anyone who hosts content. So basically, you know, Twitter has changed their policy to allow governments to demand the censored data or hidden data, I guess, I guess I wonder if that counts for direct tweets. I guess that would, right?
Dude, this is totally it does, I think. I think this is kind of all about what happens when you have investors that are not the founders and they can't like necessarily stick true to the idea of Twitter. Like, think about this. Would the Arab Spring have happened if Egypt could have censored tweets? Would the Arab Spring have happened if Libya could have...
Like, I mean, realistically, yes, but it may not have had the same impact, or it definitely would have affected
Twitter,
our coverage.
I mean, people might say, oh, Twitter wasn't a big deal, but Twitter, the ability for individuals to communicate en masse effectively had lots to do with Twitter and what it was capable of doing. And the idea that you would be able to elicit a response from the public that would get you to organize and conform and get into like Tahrir Square and all these things and really push things forward. That would not have happened if the Egyptian government could say, yeah, we're just going to censor these tweets about the revolution. So to me, this is kind of sad, based on what Twitter did in 2011. I mean, how many dictators fell from individuals making use of Twitter? A significant amount. Now, was it all Twitter? No. But at the same time, the spark starts the fire, and Twitter helped with that spark. So,
I think what we're seeing increasingly here is a sort of combination of what different countries and different societies see as the sort of norms about what is shared and what's not shared. I mean, on a realistic level, I think what's driving this is, different countries have different... Well, yeah, okay, control is definitely one. But, I mean, it's also just Twitter is an international company and they have offices in I don't know which countries, but I'm sure it's not just the U.S. anymore. And if they want to have those countries and have, those markets, then... if they don't, they're going to get kicked out of the country or hit with huge fines or their employees.
That's why I'm saying, it's clearly...
If
you're Twitter and you're focused on being Twitter, you're focused on Library of Congress. That's where you're in. You started as a service that allowed you to text message it all, like en masse and things like that. Suddenly, you're suddenly like, yeah, no, we'll just obey all these rules in these countries that are clearly not freedom based, even though like the Secretary of State herself of the United States of America tried to get Twitter to not do an update back when we knew that it was changing the way the Middle East was looking at itself. No, this is clearly an investor-based prohibition in order to maintain in relationships in countries where they want advertising dollars or whatever dollars they're going to get.
Yeah, Twitter, no, I agree.
That's what I'm saying. I don't want to use the word sellout, but it's kind of as close to it as possible.
Really, you think it's? I mean,
Twitter saved how many people's lives?
Yeah, but
our countries.
But don't they have to comply with governmental standards globally?
Standards. They weren't. I'm going to say this last thing. Then you guys can go on. Twitter did not comply with. Theoretically, Twitter did not comply with governmental standards in the Arab Spring. They followed American ideals in order to have people communicate and pursue their dreams of freedom. Now, okay, governments, do what you will. We will obey. All I'm saying is that what they were able to pursue before is not what they're pursuing now. And because of that, individuals will not be able to use Twitter the way they were to affect serious political and social change. That's all I'm saying. So whether go ahead.
Yeah, I'm gonna take a slightly sort of defensive role, not because I necessarily think that they did the right thing here, but just sort of to sort of get another sort of opinion on it. I mean, so it's not just places like Egypt and everything. I mean, Germany, for example, has very strict laws against the posting of any sort of Nazi-related propaganda or video and everything.
Germany's not a free country, and they should be taken down.
Oh my! Well,
I know.
My point is, like, every country has different, holy cows.
What does our country have?
Piracy.
What does our country say that you can't do?
Piracy.
That's not free speech, though.
Well, but I mean, the point is,
what can you not do on Twitter in our country? That's all I'm saying. That's my question.
I'm not a legal scholar. But I guess here's the thing that I sort of wanted to bring up as a point is that by allowing this to be specific to countries, Twitter has basically made it so that this stuff can still get out. So they can, like, you know, censor something in Egypt. So, okay, yeah, maybe the Egyptians won't be able to start. But they haven't censored off the system entirely. So in a sense, they can get by with the technicality of the law within the country, but then for everyone outside of the country, that information still exists. So the information can still be spread outside of it, and everyone is not subject to the laws of everyone else's country. So, I mean, yeah, it's certainly not good that this is the situation that they find themselves in, trying to figure out how to, you know, do their service legally. But at the same time, it's a great way to sort of get through the letter of the law without, you know, actually just, you know, censoring everybody's toes. Like, I'm not going to get my post deleted because they're illegal in Syria. Like, maybe the Syrians won't be able to see it, but at least I won't be stuck with that. And conversely, you know, people in the UK aren't going to get, you know, their tweets, you know, changed or whatever because whatever they're posting is violation of US law. So, I mean, I think they're in a situation where they sort of have to if they're going to be an international country. Yeah. I mean, the alternative is basically never leave the U.S. and not have any sort of international presence. And
no, the alternative is sticking to your guns and being able to do what you did in 2011 where, what was it, 3 serious dictators got knocked down. Another one died on his own. But all the time, there was
yeah, but
attempts
Wayne's
to stick on Twitter.
What happens is they can stick to their guns, but what happens if they stick to their guns is they end up in either a lawsuit or an arrest or in some way, shape, or form they're shut down in that country.
I'm not saying that Twitter shouldn't make money. I'm not saying Twitter shouldn't think about making money. You know me. I'm all about, like, where the money is coming from. I will say that Twitter's value seemed to be bigger than just dollars and cents based on a country's rules before.
Yeah. That's actually the problem I've had with Twitter, honestly, almost since the beginning. Like, Twitter as a company, I've never been entirely sure of. Twitter as a protocol, as a platform, yeah, I think is spectacular. Like, I honestly wish Twitter was something much more like email, where, like, it just exists. It's a protocol. It's not a thing. You don't, like, censor email.
That's because where they've been so powerful, and that's kind of why I look at them and I say, you know what? Like, Google's big. But Google and Yahoo and those guys have sold out to the countries that they're in, to the point where Google said, "Okay, I can't even sell it. I'm going to leave." And that was a great move. And I felt like a certain level of political justice. The Arab Spring is not a small deal, guys. The Arab Spring shows the power of an open internet to affect social and political change across the planet and make everyone more free. When Twitter decides, oh, yeah, so if they have a rule against us and what we want to say, then that's fine. That lack of free speech is what keeps people oppressed. And that's why I think this is kind of a tragedy, despite the economic incentives that they have.
Yeah, no, I agree with that aspect of it. But I don't think that's a tragedy that
they're not. Maybe they're not thinking about it. I was saying that, like, how many lives were saved by Free Egypt? When we look back in 20 years, how many lives would have been saved in Egypt where your husband can say anything and he wasn't going to get pulled out in the middle of the night by secret police? And how much money is that life worth?
I think I hear what you're saying. I think we're getting a little political here. but I think Twitter's
sorry,
probably just
assume, guys. Sorry.
They're just complying to the same standards that Google was forced to do when everyone said that they stopped not being evil. So, interestingly enough, Thailand is all very happy about this change. They were the first ones to they publicly endorse it, and they're the first ones to start implementing this, because apparently they have a what's called a lèse majeste law, which prevents criticism of the country's king and royal family.
Yeah, and it's true. They're crazy about their king and royal family.
So they're like, "Yay, Twitter!" Okay, moving on. I think this is our last headline before we get into the main topic here. So a social media first occurred this week when President Barack Obama held a Google Plus Hangout to take live questions from 5 Americans and a few people who were taped beforehand. He answered questions about the economy, job creation, small business, and the use of drones in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Almost, what about Pakistan?
That as well, I think. I think he let some information out that he may not have meant to about Pakistan, about use of drones in Pakistan. Almost as fascinating as the Hangout itself was the discussion of the Hangout on Twitter. Many wondered who chose which questions, if it was a campaign stunt, an ad for Google, a great opportunity for citizens to connect with the president, or all of the above.
This is really interesting, guys, because I don't know if you guys are familiar with super PACs and the 2011 decision by the United States Supreme Court to basically let corporations have unencumbered free speech for candidates that they like. But if you follow the 2008 election, Google was behind Barack Obama. Google's, when I say Google, I mean the people who work for Google were behind Barack Obama. When Barack Obama was in there and he was giving his relatively like fireside type chat with Google along with the other candidates, like the Google staffers were crazy about him. When he held campaign situations, those guys would donate. So the idea that Google would support this and be behind this and all that other stuff is huge. And in some ways, when 2012 becomes the nominee versus nominee election for the two big parties in America, it's Google staffers and Google support that Barack Obama's going to need to go up against Mitt Romney, who's going to get an incredible amount of support from Obama's opposition and the people and the companies behind them. So, smart political move.
I think it also makes sense. I mean, I think it also sort of shows a fundamental difference between Facebook and the Plus platform. I think Hangouts is honestly the most exciting and interesting feature about Plus, because it's something that's very unique to Plus. It basically doesn't exist on any other network. Something like this would just simply not have been possible on Facebook. I think that's an interesting thing.
Why not?
I think Obama's...
Facebook can technologically pull this off. Why... What's their disincentive to? I mean, they have chat. They have all these other things. They've copied from everyone from Foursquare to AIM. Why don't they have this, Chris?
I have no idea. I don't understand, honestly, any of the features that get added to these social networks.
I think this is quite the coup for Google Hangouts for one reason. I mean, for a couple of reasons. But one of the reasons is that I feel like a lot of people were not even aware of the existence of Google Hangouts, and the fact that this was broadcast on YouTube, which most people are aware of, was a great PR push for Google Hangouts. And also, just on a personal basis, I really want at some point for us to do the drill down via Google Hangouts too, at least just to try it out and see if it's possible. And so I love to see that this as a case study for it being done as a use case scenario here for podcasts. I would love to do podcasts over Google Hangouts and broadcast them live. I don't think most people don't have the ability to broadcast their Hangouts live over YouTube. I think some YouTube producers can, and certainly the president can, but I think most people, it's still not available.
You know, Obama's really been sort of going through the Silicon Valley sort of big tech companies. He's definitely sort of pushing Silicon Valley as, as a job creator area. I mean, he came to LinkedIn this past summer and sort of did the same thing.
He's been in Colorado too, town hall.
Yeah.
He's been pushing technology, especially when it comes to Colorado's big into solar, photovoltaic, alternative energy. He's been pushing that like nobody's business. So he's – because of job creation, the same exact thing. So.
Yeah.
Weird.
So I'm sure there'll be a Facebook event at some point in the coming years. The cynical way of interpreting this is, this is something he does now, and when November rolls around, he wants to bring out the big guns, and he'll do it on Facebook.
Well, I mean, he takes a while to get to stuff. I think a lot of people, liberal people, the people who like Obama, are very focused on, got to do this change now, got to do it quickly, got to do whatever. You have the muscle in the Senate and the House, go ahead, push this shit. He lost the muscle in the House, obviously. But I think for a long time, it was sort of why not push this stuff through? Why not push the idea of online and alternative energy? And because he was supposed to do this thing where we could see all the Senate bills and all the money and all the expenditures and everything easily and quickly online. It's still kind of buried in congress.gov or, all of these government websites and things like that. And there was the whole issue with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which he eventually flipped over. But the liberals are hungry, and they want their liberal change really, really fast. And I think that he's got to work to make sure that he can pull that off. You know what I mean? So it's good that he's coming into these places and showing them what he can do. But they always want more. So I think you're right. Like he needs to, you know, leverage this technology to his benefit. And I think Mitt Romney, if he's the nominee, he's going to have to do the same thing. He's going to have to appeal to these guys.
I think one interesting thing we're going to see about so there was some discussion in 2008, whatever, that it was sort of the social media election because of the role that Obama played in sort of fundraising and everything. And I think that as elections become more social media, I think one interesting thing we're going to see is that like social media changes every like 2-3, certainly every 4 years, which means that, you know, every 4 years, it's going to be an entirely different ballgame. It's not going to be like TV where, you know, TV has the same sort of basic structure and big players and everything. It'll be sort of interesting to see how the sort of constant change that you get in technology is going to affect elections as elections become more aware of and participatory in technology. So, anyway.
All right. Before we get into our main topic here, let's take a little break here and talk about our sponsor. Our sponsor is Audible.com, and for the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And this week, we have a very appropriate recommendation because it leads right into our main topic here. And the book is Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works by Adam Leshinsky. Adam Leshinsky is a reporter with Fortune. Among the many amazing things about Apple is how scrutinized it is. Rarely has a company, its products, and its top executive, the late Steve Jobs, been so thoroughly examined. And yet, for a corporation so frequently discussed, Apple is poorly understood. Its products ubiquitous, but information about the institution is scarce, which is exactly how Apple wants it. So in this book, Adam Leshinsky, it's a tell-all book about Apple using unofficial sources. I've actually bought this book this week, and I read it today. That's the beautiful thing that I love about Audible is that, like, I don't know how many pages this book was, but it was 6 hours on audio book. So I basically popped it in and played it during work, and I was done with it. So I'm, like, fully – I got the data injection – and I'm fully ready to.
Wow. Part of me just wants to, like, rent your particular Audible account from you. I know that's completely against for it, and I would not do that, Audible. But, I mean, that's just a great endorsement.
Yeah, so we're going to – usually we'd stop at this point and play a little snippet from the audiobooks. But since we're going to be talking about it in depth in our main segment here – I just want to say to download Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works by Adam Leshinsky or any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook. And doing so helps this show out, too, so we really appreciate it if you do that. Okay, we're going to take a little break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk about Inside Apple and Adam Leshinsky's new book here and some of Apple's secrets. So take a listen to this and come on back. Let me know that I've done wrong when I've known this all along. I go around a time or two just to waste my time with you.
Keep you my dirty little secret.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas, Christopher Bernard, and we're here live on geeksofdoom.com. And let's talk about this book here, Inside Apple, How America's Most Admired and Secretive Company Really Works. I don't know if either of you guys have read this, but I can tell you the articles that I've plucked from some of the other sites have kind of the juiciest tidbits. So as long as you read those articles, you should be fine. So some of the interesting things about what he discovered in his research, in talking to people, talking to ex-employees and talking to current employees who would not be named, was that Apple is incredibly secretive about every process that goes on. Apple employees know that something big is afoot when carpenters arrive in their office building, new walls are quickly erected, doors are added, and new security protocols put into place. Windows that were once transparent are now frosted. Other rooms have no windows at all. They're called lockdown rooms, and no information goes in and out or out without a reason.
CIA does something similar in language.
It's interesting, isn't it? And they say that he says that some employees are hired when they're hired in what they call dummy positions. In other words, they don't explain what their role is until after they join the company.
And this happens in some other companies. Like, this happens a lot in digital companies. I actually had a boss who left our company, went to another one, and they hired him, and he's walking around the office, and he's getting to know people, and only weeks after he was hired did they lay out to the rest of the people in the company what his true role was, as mostly the manager of many of the people he'd been working with for a couple weeks before.
Surprise manager.
Yeah, exactly. And he really got to get – it's kind of like that reality show, like Secret Boss or whatever. He kind of got to get a lay of the land without people sort of just showing up and kissing up to him. He got to know what was really up. And
it's interesting you say that because at least when Steve Jobs was around, there was a retreat that would happen semi-annually every year about whenever Steve Jobs could get around to it, and he called it like the Desert Island 100 or something like that. And it was essentially the 100 people that Steve Jobs felt he could not live without. Like, if he was stranded on a desert island, he'd want these 100 employees.
That's scary. Okay, him. I need you, but not your wife, your kids,
right,
or anything.
Well,
come here.
And in many cases, some of the employees that he would pick out would be subordinates to higher ranked employees. So it would be very common.
So he knows who's doing the heavy lifting.
Yeah, kind of. So it's a little weird. You'd have this whole group of people who essentially didn't make the cut. And some of them would be the bosses of the people who did make the cut, and they'd all...
That's weird. And year after year, it would probably change, right?
So yes,
like 1 year
yes.
You get in there, and the next year you're like, whoa, why wasn't I invited?
How long do you... how does that last for, yeah?
Yeah, that's kind of sad. I'm worried. I'm worried that he's not even alive anymore.
They're really a unique company in that way. I mean, like, lots of companies, you know, have this, you know, desire for secrecy and everything, but, like, Apple... Like, it's almost like part of their marketing of it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know
but
if they
pays
think about
off,
it.
Pays off, right? Like, it's a big money maker for them. If you,
you know when you if you about, visit I'm sorry, go ahead. I cut you off there, Duane.
Oh, I was just going to say, if you're really secretive about your stuff, but you make great stuff, people are going to show up and say, you know, I want to know. That rumor mill before the iPhone 4S came out, I mean, that sold the iPhone 4S. People were crazy about that thing. You can't get that kind of marketing normally. Like, people are working really hard in marketing right now and advertising to get, like, the social word of mouth going. Apple, like, has that without even trying now. They just have to shut up. The power of less is more, you know?
Well, it also comes out of the fact that this is something I've been really impressed with since I switched from Android to iPhone. Apple does... And for listeners of Geeks of Doom, I am definitely not an Apple fanboy. I've railed against them, and the iPhone that I bought is honestly the first Apple product I have owned besides an iPod Nano.
Wait, Chris, don't you have a MacBook Pro 15 with 8 gigs of RAM in it?
No.
No, that's me. I have a. It's a Mac Pro.
Oh, I see.
With
I see.
Yeah, I mean, I
got one from LinkedIn.
Yeah, but I didn't get to keep that. Oh, I had to give it back when I left.
Did you like that computer when you had it, Chris?
It was okay. There were an awful lot of aspects of my Linux machine that I missed, but I ended up, you know, being relatively happy with it. But the thing I was going to say about this is Apple, unlike almost every other company out there, does complete products. Like, it doesn't really make any sense to, you know, for what their products are, to rumor about, like, the specs or, you know, what features it's going to have or not have, because Apple doesn't their products are not an amalgamation of features the way most companies view their products. Their products are complete works, and you may like them or you may not, but they are, you know, complete in what they are. And so, honestly, I think, like, it's good for them, honestly, to sort of build up that buzz. But in a sense, I think it would also be bad for them and their products if their products sort of got rumored out, you know, early and in an incomplete format. Because then we would, you know, think about them much more as, you know, oh, the features that it's going to have as opposed to the actual product that it is.
I actually agree with you and disagree with you. I agree with you on the one hand because, like, look at this. I agree with you on the one hand because, like, yeah. I was talking to a coworker today. And he's like, "Yeah, you know, I got an iPad 2 for Christmas, but I took it back because I want the iPad 3 because it'll have a quad core." And I'm like, "Well, Apple doesn't really care about specs. If you build the product, that's like we were talking about with consoles earlier.
Right.
If you build the software for the product, specs don't matter. But it's gonna be faster because it has a quad core." So I had to kind of begin to school him, and he just kind of got bothered by the idea that I could even focus on that. So I agree with you on that, but I disagree with you because Siri is clearly a beta product that was
that's a first differentiation.
It may be a first, but it is a differentiation feature for the 4S over the iPhone 4. So as a person just looking at it, try and look at it objectively. You know, I own products by Apple. I own products not by Apple. I'm on a Windows machine right now. I feel like it's not a comprehensive understanding of what it is they try to do.
Yeah.
That Siri, Leshinsky points out in his book that's a first for the Apple has never released a beta product before, so that's kind of a first for them, and it signals perhaps a new direction that is maybe indicates where they're going now in the wake of the passing of Steve Jobs. And one of the interesting highlights from the book is that on the first day when you are hired at Apple, and the first day that you're hired, there's no one there to help you connect your newly issued computer. So basically they assume that if you've been hired by Apple, you're smart enough and tech savvy enough to hook yourself up to the network.
Really? Or is it just that their shit is so easy to use that you should?
Well, that partially, I mean, I'm assuming that they issue Macs to the new employees, right?
They better.
Here's your HP Envy.
Yes. But yeah, supposedly though that the new employees aren't completely on their own. They have what's called like an iBuddy, and that iBuddy is kind of a veteran of Apple who's been there and who will help them out for like the first week or so in. Unofficially help them
out. I
can't
talk to you anymore because it's after the first week.
Yeah, pretty much.
And wait, how is that different from like other big companies?
Oh, dude, like, you're in a big company. Like, first of all, you're in a big company. You'll get in, they'll hire you, and if it's a big enough company, you won't get an email address or a phone number for a week. If it's a normal size company that happens to be a little big, you'll get your stuff within a week, and someone will come and set you up, and you'll have to like kind of stand there while the IT guy goes and like hooks all your shit up, and then you'll call him up 15 minutes later, I can't get this to work, and he figures shit out for you. That's kind of how those things work. But like, if you're in a big enough company, you literally won't get your shit forever.
On LinkedIn, we just got like a laptop and they gave us our password. And
LinkedIn has still got a startup feeling. It's only like, what, 5-7 years old? You know, like,
yeah,
LinkedIn,
but it's like 2,000 people there.
Right, I mean, but it's 2,000 techies as opposed to like I was working at like the biggest law firm in the country. And I remember them being like, yeah, so, you know, you'll get your logins in a couple days. Meanwhile, just show up. Like,
oh. I guess, I don't know, it's hard for me to compare because I've always been, you know, in some way, shape, or form on the tech side of things. So either I was in a position where I was being hired to hook up other people's computers, mm-hmm. or there just, you know, wasn't anything, you know, I don't know.
I was there to bring tech to people, and it was just clear that the people did not have the tech already.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I have, you know, I knew a couple of people when I was at LinkedIn that worked at Apple, and I sort of asked them bits and pieces, and they weren't able to tell me a huge amount. As far as I could tell, most of these types of stories are true. Like, Apple is a very different place.
In fact, Leshinsky points out in his book, he says that it's the secrecy at Apple is strictly enforced from within. And for example, a Valley engineer who plays poker regularly with a team of Apple employees said that the understanding is that if Apple comes up as a topic during their card playing, the subject will be changed. Being fired for blabbing is a well-founded concern. People working on launch events will be given watermarked paper copies of a booklet called Rules of the Road that details every milestone leading up to launch day. In the booklet is a legal statement whose message is clear. If this copy ends up in the wrong hands, the responsible party will be fired. So that's
and probably not just fired under certain circumstances.
Yes, in fact, he says in the book.
What does it mean by not just fired? You mean blacklisted?
Yes. No, not just fired, but prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Though that's the exact wording that he uses in the book. So, I mean, it really puts the fear of God into all
Apple. I wonder what their offer letters look like. Their offer letter has to be pretty long in order to pull that prosecutor to the full extent of law.
Also, that Leshinsky did an interview at LinkedIn headquarters, and a person identifying himself as a former Apple employee confirms what Leshinsky says is that Apple allegedly puts new engineers on fake products until they can rise to a certain degree of trust, which then grants them the opportunity to work on prototype Apple devices that have more than a 0% chance of seeing the light of day. So they'll be working on in dummy positions on fake products for a little while until they can be trusted. That's a little weird.
No, that makes sense, because the only way to maintain a good corporate culture is to make that culture something that people feel like they've earned. Yeah. If you get into a corporation and you suddenly have all the privileges, it's not going to work. But if you get into the corporation, even like you go to Goldman Sachs, right? You're like an intern. You're an intern that's in the investment banking division. You're an analyst, whatever. You're not going to just get the job at the end of the year. They cut off people. The bottom two scores of whatever test they're going to give or whatever evaluation process they're going to give, you know, bottom X amount of people, those guys get cut off. Why? Because they haven't earned the culture. They don't have what it takes to be part of the culture, even though they got into the internship program, which is like the holy grail of any finance students, whatever. And that makes the other people realize what they have. You have to have some sort of way to differentiate the noobs from the fully fledged in order to have a culture that sticks around. Every culture does it. You go through your vision quest in certain aspects of First Americans. You go through your confirmation or your bat mitzvah, bas mitzvah when you're in like Judeo-Christian religions. It's what you go through, like, and that's what they're doing. Apple excels at creating a culture, and that culture cannot happen if you don't have some sort of barrier to entry. As in, are you truly trusted? Are you truly a believer? Can you? And that question is, can you follow these rules? And they're simple rules.
Interesting about that is in a corporate structure, spending that much money and time on an employee who isn't doing anything productive for the company would be unheard of, except
it's the value of the individual.
Well, but
the company is the most valuable company in the world.
Right.
They didn't get there.
Right.
Enough.
And according to Leshinsky's book, they have basically this unlimited budget, and there are no real sort of deadlines other than launch date deadlines for products and stuff like that. But other than that, they can spend as much money as they want and take as much time as they need to develop these products.
Yeah. Well, you know, they have one of the – I don't know what the exact term is, but they have monstrous cash reserves. Like, for a company of their size, they keep a huge amount of cash on hand, which is, you know, in many cases considered a bad thing actually for companies, because it sort of you know, analysts are like, well, if you have the cash, what are you using it for? Like, either give back to your investors or, you know, invest it in something where it's earning money. But that cash gives them a huge amount of flexibility in terms of, you know, what they can do and what they can afford to spend money on, because, you know, it's not like it's, you know, yeah. Sorry.
Well, I don't know. I feel like on some, okay. So like cash reserves, great. Like, this is one of the differences between a normal public company and Apple Inc. A normal public company is like, why do we have all this cash reserves? Let's go. Here we go. We're going to do whatever we have to do. Apple Inc. is like, look, we're focused on getting the product done correctly. Now, if you're focused on getting the product done correctly and long-term gain, which Apple has been, Apple's always played the long game. It's kind of amazing. You're going to look at what it takes to get there. It takes talent to get there. And if you haven't noticed recently, there's been a lot of talent fighting back and forth in Silicon Valley that, you know, Apple and Facebook, Google, and all these other guys. And they're going to work really hard to make sure they have talent that's not only good at what they do, but dedicated to what they do. And that's kind of where this sort of like seemingly unlimited budget comes from.
Yeah.
It's clear that this has worked. If it hadn't worked, they wouldn't have the incredible market cap position that they do have. So if you're a shareholder, if there's one thing you can do, it's trust in the Apple process. And that process is to take an individual and school him in their ways after finding like direct talent. That's what works for the company. And yeah, I don't want to talk about Apple forever, but the bottom line is the company, its systems work really well. They output great products because they have a great PR engine. They have a great advertising engine, and they have even more than all those things. They have a great product engine. You know, the product engine is these people doing what they have to do, and it ties back in to this idea that they're not going to leak the details of products. They're not going to leak the details of strategy. It's going to come out when it comes out. When it comes out, it's going to be relatively finished, with the exception of Siri, which again you said is not a clear. It's an aberration in the Apple way of doing things.
Right. I want to shift topics here away from the Leshinsky book to an article that was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago called How the U.S. Lost Out on – I'm sorry. The New York Times changes their titles all the time. And now it's called How the U.S. Lost Out on iPhone Work. Before it was called Apple, America, and a Squeezed Middle Class. And the summary of this article was that not long ago, Apple boasted that its products were made in America, and today few of them are. I mean,
now they boast that their products are designed in America.
Designed in America, yeah.
But they're designed by an Englishman, so I don't really know.
But almost all of the,
a knighted Englishman,
yeah,
I know.
But almost all of the iPhones, the 70 million iPhones, 30 million iPads, and 59 million other products are manufactured overseas. President Obama asked Steve Jobs at a dinner for Silicon Valley's top luminaries last February, why can't that work come home? And Jobs' reply was unambiguous. Those jobs are not coming back. So the president.
Well, I mean, there's a reason for that. And if you've been following sort of like some of the caveats that have come through, there was this great talk about how Steve Jobs pulled an iPhone, a prototype iPhone out of his pocket in 2007 and said, or 2006, and said, guys, my screen is scratched because this was in the corner. This was in there with my pocket, with my keys, my pocket with my keys. It's all scratched up because it's made of plastic. Tim Cook did his magic, and he got a company to use Gorilla Glass or whatever glass was on the original iPhone and redo, you know, remake that process so that the glass can be introduced. The company hired thousands, tens of thousands of people. It put them up in dormitories.
Yeah.
And you can't do that in America. I can't tell you to leave your suburban home and come live in a dormitory with me to put together a device that other people will pay you for enough money. You know what I mean?
Well,
like, you can't do that.
There's actually more to that story, Dwayne, because that is actually from this article. So I don't know if it was Cook or what. I'm assuming it was Cook. So they have that meeting, and you know, executive flies out to Japan to start looking at, you know, companies that have bid. So within like a few days, you know, they're looking for companies who are bidding on this, and the first company they go to like already has a new wing under construction, and they go, oh, what's that wing for? And he's like, oh, that's a wing that we're going to build this in if we get the contract. Like,
that was
it
in
was
Japan
already,
or in China?
That was in China. That was the place that eventually got it. Like, they showed up to just to see the contract, and there's already under construction. Like, that sort of thing doesn't happen here. Right. And that's partly just sort of different economics. That's partly the fact that the Chinese government, you know, pays for a lot of that stuff, gives, you know, either tax breaks or, you know, low interest loans or whatever to sort of help, you know, the manufacturing just grow. It's also
they just have to keep their currency artificially low, and then it becomes valuable to do the product, to build a product there.
Yeah, and the other problem is you know, the New York Times article pointed out it's not just a matter of wages. Like the amount of money that paying American wages would add to each iPhone is about like I don't know, $65 or something, which is impressive, but it's not like huge. But the real cost of doing stuff not in Asia is the fact that the entire supply chain is over there. Like you can have, you know, the screen in one plant and the processor in another plant and the you know, the touch interface in a third plant, and they're all like within a few hours of each other. There's no like, you know, shipping things halfway across the world and having factories sit dormant because, you know, a ship got delayed. It's all right there. And that's a really sort of dangerous thing for the US and, you know, other countries that are losing manufacturing jobs, because even if we build the greatest you know, factories in the world, they're going to be halfway around the world from all the other greatest factories in the world.
Let me ask you a question here. What would you think about a boutique iPhone? Like, would you pay like $100+ extra dollars for an iPhone that was completely made in America?
I don't know. It depends. If the quality is better, then maybe.
So it's about the quality.
The same, if the quality, well, I mean, if it is, right? If like Chris has some good points. Having all these parts next to one another means that the people who are putting them together have more practice.
Sure.
The more practice they have putting it together, the better it's going to be put together. If we're having, you know, maybe you can say that if the more time someone has to put it together, the better. So that, like, you know, maybe they're like, you know, let's say 1 million iPhones are made in the United States and like the other 29 million iPhones are made outside of the United States, and those million iPhones in the United States are seriously better. I think it's strange and somewhat – it's just really – it's culturally outside of things to say I'm going to pay more because this device is the exact same as every other device is made in America. You know, like it begins to – one of the weird things about an iPhone, and this used to be the case with a couple other products in America, is that like a Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola was renowned because the richest man in the world wants a Coca-Cola. It's the same Coke that the poorest man in the world who can afford a Coca-Cola can
have.
Right now – you know, you see like these modern day like super paparazzi superstar people, like, you know, whether it's Kim Kardashian or the king or the Prince of Wales, they use iPhones. They do. It's to them it's the best phone around, and for anyone who can afford $200 or a free iPhone 3GS, it's the best phone around. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that you'd make some artificial stratification because it's you know, you can get one built in the US versus not built in the US, it seems anathema to the very idea that the iPhone is the iPhone is the iPhone is the iPhone.
Well, it would still be the iPhone. It would still be exactly the same, but it would be made by American workers.
It'd be different because it has a different badge in it. Because it has a different, it would say, you know, designed in California by Apple, you know, by Apple Inc. and then like assembled in America.
Yeah.
That would make it that different. And the problem is that suddenly. People would not. I feel like people would not buy the Chinese one in some cases because they're holding out for the other one or whatever. Uh-huh. It makes it. It's an inefficient supply chain.
You give them the option. You say, you know, you can.
Level of price discrimination, I think, is inefficient as opposed to I'm going to ask you for $100 more for more space.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just think it's an inefficient. It's an inefficient way to do price discrimination.
Interesting.
It's
I think it's also sort of not a technical. I don't know. I don't want to get into that. I mean, I guess the problem I have with that is it ends up being much more of a political than tech question. I don't want to get into my political theory.
Well, I mean, we're basically talking about technology, the labor of building technology overseas as opposed to here. And all of that stuff is going overseas or has gone overseas. And now that stuff has a, you know, made in China – doesn't have the same negative connotation today as it did when I was a kid, you know?
So. Right. Made in Taiwan, made in China used to mean that, like, you had, like, a pair of flip-flops and it was going to fall apart in 5 seconds. Now, you'll have, like, you know, made in Taiwan, you'll get an HTC that HTC will not last as long as an iPhone. Assembling China, you're like, okay, who cares? It was designed by Apple and Cupertino. and it really keeps the thing. So I think it's a non-entity now, whether it's made in China or not. If you're buying food and that food has ingredients from China, you might think twice about it. Let's go back to the whole fake protein thing, whatever. Baby formula, all that stuff. But when it comes to like a hardware product, you're kind of like, that's fine. Who designed it? You know?
Yeah.
One more thing before we move on to our final word is I wanted to also bring up a little news tidbit about Apple's a patent that came up this last week. Did you see this?
No.
So Apple has shown interest in building a new simplified remote control that would automatically control a variety of devices while reducing setup and frustration for the users. The patent describes a touchscreen-based controller that would reduce the confusing clutter found on current universal remotes. With a dynamic touchscreen used for input, the remote would include a discovery mechanism that would discover available appliances for it to control, negating the need for users to enter complex code and program individual devices. What confuses me about this is that I have a Harmony remote, and I don't see much difference between what this can do and the Harmony, other than maybe the discovery mechanism.
I don't know. Like, I feel like, have you seen the Peel Fruit? That's very focused on discovery.
Yes.
It's got lots
yes.
of Harmony features in terms of using multiple devices to do like the IR Blaster. And they sell that on Apple.com, stored at Apple.com. I feel like they're probably one-upping that. And I feel like the Harmony, I've actually looked into Harmony. I was thinking about getting one because I can get like a Harmony Link or whatever. I haven't been able to commit. I just haven't. So maybe that's, I don't know. I want a lot of my media off my Mac. I don't know.
Go for
it. We'll see how this does. And people who are Mac heads, like, yeah, Logitech and Mac have been paired up forever, and it's been wonderful. But I can see a lot of people just holding out for something with an Apple logo on it.
Yeah, Andrew, I think you're making the I got cut off a little bit there, but I think to say what you're saying is to make the classic, you know, Apple mistake of, oh my gosh, an iPod, just we need another iPhone or another mm-hmm. MP3 player. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I mean, what Apple brings to its products, whether you like them or not, is sort of a coherent whole to them, like we were talking about earlier.
So the experience...
It's almost definitely going to be tied into Apple TV and or iTunes
right.
and or, you know, whatever they come up with for the living room. But there's that intriguing quote that Jobs had sort of shortly before his death where he said, we cracked it, we got
yeah.
TV. And so I'm pretty excited to see what they're going to come out with there.
So the overall experience is more than just this particular part, this one unique
yeah.
component. Mm.
And the integration. People look for that logo and be like, oh, it'll work with everything I own made by this company.
All right.
And nothing else. Especially if you have a Linux machine, then it'll definitely not work.
All right. Let's take another little break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk about our final word, which is Facebook's IPO that they just announced today. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down. We're live on geeksofdoom.com. I'm Andy Cersini. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Christopher Bernard. And let's talk about Facebook's IPO listing. Today, Facebook just filed their IPO, and they're looking to raise $5 billion in a letter from founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg. About Facebook's purpose, he explains, Facebook was not originally created to be a company. It was built to accomplish a social mission to make the world more open and connected. We think it's important that everyone who invests in Facebook understands what this mission means to us. Zuckerberg also describes Facebook's internal mantra known as the hacker way. He says the word hacker has an unfairly negative connotation. Hacking just means building something quickly or testing the boundaries of what can be done. The Hacker Way is an approach to building that involves continuous improvement and iteration. We have the words "done is better than perfect" painted on our walls. And his letter concluded with Facebook's 5 core principles: focus on impact, move fast, be bold, be open, and build social value. What did you guys think about this announcement?
I was impressed by their numbers, I have to admit, offhand. I just thought that was amazing. So they operated at something like $3 billion in revenues and something $1.6 billion in profits. That is incredible. That is a big league company. I think that far dwarfs, I don't remember exactly what LinkedIn's filings were, you know, the sort of second biggest big IPO recently. I think it was in the hundreds of millions, but this is big. And it's also really impressive. I mean, how much of
it's
Facebook
big, but how, mm-hmm. I mean, like that it's big, but think about it this way. Google 2011, $37.9 billion, $40 billion. You know, what was the Facebook number you just quoted?
$1.6 billion.
Right. So it's big, but it's not big. Like you said this before, Chris. We were talking, and you mentioned how you were surprised that Facebook, on some level, didn't want to make a money printing machine out of just like ads on the side. I think that their strategy is focused on this long-term thing. They've got apps that make money. They've got other ways of making money. They've got the advertisers. But they've got a long way to go before they can really begin to take on their current competitors, which are Google and Apple, right?
Yeah.
They've got Google's going to have to deal with some antitrust stuff, but they just threw their social network into their search results, which people have mixed feelings about, but everybody knows will expand their voice in the, mm-hmm. in the space. And they also understand that it'll also expand Google's between that and Google's new advertising campaign about how they're changing the way they deal with your privacy, and they're sharing data between their websites and other sites and their networks and everything like that. Like, Google's about to turn from a $40 billion company, I think, into a $50 billion company. And Facebook, you know, it's just got an IPO and everything, but it's got a long way to go before it really becomes. I mean, it's clearly a big league company. Clearly, you know.
I was actually expecting a $10 billion
IPO.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it doesn't matter in the end. Mark Zuckerberg is worth $28 billion, and the company is worth about $100 billion right now. We'll see if that goes skyrockets up and then falls down. We'll see what happens. I think that it's really important to realize that big company, but Facebook was a private company, a humongous private company in a small pond. Now they're a reasonably sized big company in a humongous pond. And as much as they have 845 million users, the active users are going to become big, the minority shareholders, because all these millionaires were made with this IPO, and they're going to want their money.
Absolutely.
So they're going to start selling off to these, whether they're institutional investors or just regular investors. All these little mouths are going to start showing up saying, hey, I'm a minority investor, and I need you to do this, and I need you to do that, and we're going to start voting, we're going to start doing this and that. And Zuckerberg doesn't have 51% of the company, as is the case with some Google guys. So we really have to pay attention to what's going to happen, because it might move in a direction that we are totally not going to be able to anticipate.
It's going to be interesting to see what kind of a company Facebook becomes now that they're beholden to shareholders.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That was my. I'm sorry, I couldn't say that quicker.
But you know what's interesting about this is that seeing who owns what, like Zuck owns 28.2% of the company, and it's interesting that not listed in the chart of major shareholders is Sean Parker and co-founder Eduardo Saverin, who were two of the subjects of Social Network movie.
They've got money. They may not be major, but they got paid. And I mean, Eduardo, maybe not. We saw the movie. Everyone looked into him on the Wikipedia afterward. It kind of sucks, maybe. But it depends on what your real value was. And the movie, again, wasn't a real experience. It was a...
True.
You know, whatever. It was dramatized heavily.
Right.
But I think that, you know, like, Sean Parker, he's got some money. He's okay. He's not worried about things. And more than money, he still probably has some say, which he probably cares about more given his personality. Mm-hmm. You know, Justin Timberlake depiction aside.
Facebook won't face any new regulations or government oversight specifically related to privacy, but in the cases of inquiries from the FTC or attorneys general, investigations that might otherwise remain private could become public because Facebook will be forced to disclose events that will have a material impact on earnings. So they're going to be some of their issues, privacy-related issues that in the past they'd kept to themselves, much to the chagrin of Facebook users. Now is going to be some of that stuff may be made public. Any last words on Facebook, et cetera, and their IPO before we wrap things up tonight?
Well, I mean, like, the company started out in 2003, really. It's 2012, so that's 9 years. We should all be blessed to have a company that's 9 years old have so much crazy scrutiny, but so much crazy popularity and success. So, you know, like, Zuckerberg, I wish him the best. I think he's got a lot on his shoulders for a young man. Yeah, he's cocky in some respects. Yeah, he's like, you know, whatever. But at the same time, you know, it's that American story. It's, you know, Carnegie and mm-hmm. Morgan and all those guys. Like, you can be this young guy. And it's also that internet story of the 90s, relived by a millennial. And I think, you know, like, I do have my foibles with Facebook. I'm not, like, a complete fanboy. I have some issues with them. I watch them carefully. I've studied all their privacy rules, regulations, their developer regulations and everything like that in accordance with, like, what I have to do for a living and kind of sure. my own personal edification. And there's a lot there that I'd rather see changed. But it doesn't mean that they haven't given exceptional value to our way of thinking, our way of life, and that they haven't tried to push culture. So I am congratulating them on their success. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
And you agree. Okay.
I can't give any more to that.
All right. Let's go around the table here, and I'm going to start with you, Chris. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Well, you can most often find me at Chrisprenor on Twitter, Chrisburnor. And I am now co-curating the Startup Digest reading list, which is a list of the best tech and startup articles from around the web, mm-hmm. And I'm doing the tech side of that. And everything else I do is on chrisprenor.com, my Tumblr and whatever social media I'm currently obsessed with at the moment.
And Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find you online?
You can find me at my Tumblr. It's beyondthegeek.tumblr.com. You can also find me at twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also find me at Google+, gplus.to. /DwayneD, and you can find me on flavors.me /DwayneD. I do a lot of things with DWAYNED in them because that's my name. Don't worry about it.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or gplus.to/MrBabyMan. You can check out thedrilldown.com for all of our past episodes. Subscribe to us on iTunes. It's going to be a little difficult right now because Mevio cut off our access here, but we'll post as soon as we can. We'll post a new location where our where you can catch our feed. You can always go to facebook.com/thedrilldown and twitter.com/thedrilldown. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com, and we will try to publish it on thedrilldown.com. You can let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our lovely audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. We, of course, thank geeksofdoom.com for hosting our show and the wonderful Geeks of Doom audience, and we hope to see you guys again next week. And so be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.